You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by ProncPops.wordpress.com and KDUX Web Radio. WordPress.com. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District.
Welcome to the Pronk Pop Show. This is the Thursday edition. By now, you've probably heard on your local news that the House of Representatives today passed by a 217. The Republicans needed at least 216 votes. 217 to 213. So it was close. They finally did the right thing and made sure before they called the vote that they had the votes. They did have the votes. And now, and this is important to emphasize, it has to go to the Senate. This is just the first step. The Senate will pass whatever language, whatever they want in the bill, and then it will have to go to a joint conference committee to resolve differences. My only problem with what the House passed, actually there's several. There was a much easier way to deal with the pre-existing condition situation, and that is allow individuals to purchase from associations health insurance. Now, why would you do that? Most people have their health insurance through their employer, and most people are satisfied with it. There's always people complaining that they wish they had another plan or better benefits. Since I dealt with businesses for many, many years, marketing retirement plans as well as health insurance plans, the big driver for the business is what can they afford. It is affordability. Don't have any doubts about that. Most businesses need to not only recruit, they need to retain good people. And they know if they're going to retain good people, they better have a good, or at least adequate, if not outstanding, group health insurance. That is almost invariably the first benefit a business, small, medium, or large, puts in. Because today, individuals, their employees working for the businesses expect it. Now, there's a long history as to why that is, and I'm not going to go into it. And most employers will pay at least for the employee, if not for their families. Occasionally, or since the price of or the premiums for health insurance have gone up and up and up, many employers today require some contribution on the part of the employee to pay for the family coverage for the spouse and the children. Now, many spouses also work, and then you get in a situation, which is the best plan? And sometimes the best plan is with the spouse. So if you have a husband and wife and the wife has a best plan, they tend to put the dependent coverage, if they have any children, on the wife's policy. Now, what you have to understand is there's no medical underwriting. There are no questions asked. And the simple reason is you're dealing with insurance, and insurance, you're trying to pool the risk. Everyone pays a premium, the same premium. And because of that, let's say you have someone with a pre-existing condition, let's say cancer or multiple heart attacks, strokes, that person probably will have, and the actuaries look at this, the most claims. It depends on the people in the group. Just because someone has a heart attack doesn't mean they're going to have another one. Just because someone has had a stroke doesn't mean they're going to have another stroke. Same thing with a cancer, but cancers do come back. But because it's a group, there's no medical questions to ask. Because they're quoting you a price for what? Not an individual, but for the entire group. And some of these groups are very, very large. The smallest, when I was in the business, was 2 to 9 people. And when I mean 2 to 9, I mean 2 separate families. Typically, the owner would be 1, and 2 would be is the first employee hired. Let's say, and there are many people out there, that they're the sole employee, sole proprietorships. They were limited to individual coverage, and it's in individual coverage where pre-existing conditions comes in, because individual coverage prior to Obamacare was medically underwritten. Now, the reason I'm briefly reviewing this, and I am trying to be brief here. In individual coverage, you have to fill out an application. It's just like life insurance. You got to fill out an application, and they're medical questions, and they're quoting you a price. But it's understood that it has to be medically underwritten. Part of the process is just filling out that application, and the person that wants the coverage fills it out. And when it gets to underwriting in the insurance company, what the insurance company does is go to an organization called the Medical Information Bureau, and they have records of everyone's claims history. So they will look at it, and that's where occasionally you'll discover that someone has major claims. They hopefully have disclosed it on the application. Whether or not they've disclosed it, it will come up. And one or three things happen. Usually it's a decline. They won't issue the policy. Or it's the premiums are increased. Now, they're not arbitrarily doing it. It's because the person has a pre-existing condition and they know there'll be higher, much higher in some cases, claims than a situation where someone is healthy. Also keep in mind is the premiums. It's usually a bracket. It's age. So if you're typically, let's say, 19 to 29, it's one price. If you're between 30 and 39, it's another. So as you get older, the premiums increase. And then you have male, female as well. Now, I'm giving you this sort of quick overview because a lot of people think, well, I shouldn't be charged for having a pre-existing condition. Excuse me. The insurance company is not a charity. It's not the government. It's not a charity. They discriminate. You better believe they discriminate. That's why they're asking the questions, and that's why they're checking on you. There are two examples that you usually hear to try to illustrate this, because some people don't get it. It seems obvious to me, though. You get in car insurance before you have the accident. You get fire insurance before there's a fire. That's the way it works. And you fill out an application, answer a few questions, and based on the application, they'll quote you a price, and if you like it, you can accept it. And if an event happens, let's say you total your car or your house burns down, then it pays off. The same analogy applies to health insurance. You don't wait until you're sick or have a pre-existing condition, such a heart attack, cancer, stroke. The list is a lot longer to go out and buy insurance. I'm giving you this brief explanation because the way to handle the pre-existing condition issue, if you will, is to enable individuals that are members of an association, think of it as a large group, to buy insurance from that association. You'd have to be a member of the association. Now, why would insurance companies, when they write it individually, charge you more or reject you versus an association? Well, with an association, you're spreading the risk. Some of these associations have thousands, tens of thousands of people that are members. So that's a nice piece of business for the insurance company to have, and they're spreading the risk over a large group. So you can get a better plan and lower premiums by allowing that. This, in my mind, should be the answer to pre-existing conditions. Then you don't need subsidies from the federal government, the state, at all. Because individuals have the choice. You can get it through your employer, you can get it through an association, or you can buy, if you're healthy, you can buy individual coverage, whichever you like. Prior to Obamacare, the way it was handled in many states, including Texas, you had a special risk pool for people that have pre-existing conditions. And you could buy coverage. It was going to be expensive, more expensive than if you were healthy or you had it through your group, but it was subsidized. You better believe it was subsidized. And now the federal government is getting the act to subsidize it. I want the federal government to largely stay out of the insurance industry. That's why I'm for total complete repeal of Obamacare. But for those that are really concerned and they go on and on about the sob stories, that would address pre-existing conditions without government subsidies. Now, for let's say you had that situation, but you still would like to have an individual participate in a special risk pool. In other words, give him a fourth alternative. He could do it through the state. Well, the state taxpayers are subsidizing him. And now, under this bill, we'll be subsidizing him at the federal level. The federal governments will subsidize the state. Now, my heart goes out for the people that have a pre-existing condition. I'm not a cold character here. But the responsible thing to do is, again, if you have the money, and this is key here, that's the big qualifier, is to keep health insurance in place. And if you truly need health insurance, work for a company that provides it. That's my first answer would be go work for a company, preferably a large company, but any size company that has good health insurance. Most companies today have health insurance because they need to attract people. It's not difficult to understand. I don't know the exact number, but upwards about of 160 million plus get their coverage through group. Maybe 20 million get it through individual plans that they buy on their own. Then the government's involved with Medicare, Medicaid, and government hospitals for the military. The government is probably payer upwards of 50% of all the medical bills. Now, what the Democrats have been pushing, and they've been pushing and pushing for this, haven't been able to get it passed. And I don't think we'll ever get it passed, quite frankly. But they never give up. They're persistent. I'll give them credit. They're persistent. They want single payer, where the single payer is the government. Now, they'll call it universal care, government care, whatever. My problem with that is simple. If you want to decrease premiums, decrease deductibles, improve the quality of the service and the products, you need competition. The last thing you want is government involvement. Now, in some companies, you have government care, but they allow private insurance. That's one way to go. If it were me and my preference only, we'd have an entirely private, competitive market for health insurance. Minimize the government's involvement. On the federal level, what they do need to do is allow companies that want to do it, many don't want to do it, is to offer a product in all 50 states. And that's what President Trump wants, more competition between the states. In other words, if a company is writing business in Texas, if they want to, they can offer it to everybody in the United States. You see, what you need to understand is prior to Obamacare, it was the states that were primarily responsible for regulating the insurance industry, both who could write business in a state, and they also reviewed and approved plans, whether it's life insurance, disability, health insurance. I want the maximum competition, and I want to give as much choice as possible to the consumer. And that's why I said yesterday I was all in favor of what? Associations being permitted under law, and you got to pass a law, that they can offer a comprehensive health insurance, really catastrophic care is what you should get. And then if your employer offers a health savings account, fine, or you can save your own money and pay for the small doctor bills, small medical bills. You should always do business with the best company you can afford and have the highest deductible you can afford, because that saves you a lot of money. Because the insurance companies, they'd rather not mess with the small claims, because there's administrative costs involved. If they're claims, they want the big ones, not the several hundred dollar ones. An example you'll hear used, you don't get car insurance to replace the oil. Next week, I'm going to where I have my car serviced. Don't go there very often. But I know I need to get my battery, one of the, you know, you have positive and negative, it's building up. So I want it cleaned. And I want the fluid checks, the tire check. I don't need an oil change for a while. Routine maintenance. I don't buy insurance for that. I don't know what the bill will be. Definitely under $100. You don't buy insurance for that. And that's the point. Doctors, unless you're dealing with a specialist, typically it varies all over the lot. $50, $100, $150. It depends what doctor, where, what city, where you're located, what you're going in for. There's a whole lot of variables here. What frustrates me is I prefer to pay cash, and they're not set up to pay cash because who pays the bills? Largely insurance companies. It's either the insurance companies or government, and they make good money. But the ones that got involved with Obamacare are leaving. And the reason is adverse selection. The people that have pre-existing conditions, they were the first ones to sign up. You better believe it. They were on the computers, the Obamacare site that was having so much trouble. You better believe they were the first ones. You see, Obamacare could only work if they could force young people to buy health insurance. That's why they mandated, that's a fancy way to say, you are required to buy health insurance. And when I heard this, I said, good luck, because the young people have better things to spend their money on. And don't misunderstand me. I recommend that they have a catastrophic plan with a high deductible to take care of the unanticipated large claims. That's the responsible thing to do. But they do think they're going to live forever. And they do have the fewest claims. That's why it's cheaper for 19-year-olds to buy insurance than a 69-year-old person. It's common sense here. Insurance companies discriminate. You better believe they discriminate. They should discriminate. They evaluate the risk. And think of it in terms of life insurance. If you've had a series of heart attacks, you're more likely to die than someone that's young and has never had any problem and is physically fit. You know, some of the common questions, you know, what's your height? What's your weight? Have you lost a lot of weight or increased a lot of weight lately? What's your occupation? And do you engage in certain risky activities like hang kite flying where you hang from it? It is risky. Parachute jumping. So there are risky occupations. It's going to be rated up or they're not going to take you. Same thing with if you're engaged in some supports, that's high risk. They're trying what underwriters do, both in the field, which was I was doing, but what they do at the home office. They evaluate the applicant. Is this a normal situation or is it a situation where this person could die tomorrow or this person could have excessive claims, benefit claims, if it's health insurance? I don't know where this bill is going to end. And the problem we have is there's some very good ideas from the Senate. And you have senators that want to get back to a free market situation. Unfortunately, we have Republicans, both in the House and the Senate, that are interventionist. They want the government intervening, regulating, taxing, telling you what you can or cannot buy and what you must do if you're selling something. Now, some people that believe, Democrats and Republicans, that's terrific. I don't, because what it does is drive up cost. And if they could not handle or finesse the pre-existing condition situation, I knew this bill wasn't going to pass. You see, the way it works, if this bill goes forward, states can apply for a waiver to the Secretary Tom Price of Health and Human Resources. And it'll probably be granted for the simple reason the states will opt out in terms of pre-existing conditions. In other words, guaranteed issue for individual coverage. Because they know if you have community rating where it's the same price for everybody, what happens? They can't compete. Now, you do have different prices for males, females, and different ages. And that's legitimate. Now, I didn't intend this program to be a mini lecture on health insurance or insurance in general. But the reason why I'm emphasize this is there's a lot of people out here that don't understand insurance. Insurance is forward-looking. It's to protect you from an event in the future. And to do that, they need a pool of applicants to spread the risk because some will never have a claim or very few claims. And the insurance companies love those people. I'm more or less that way in terms of car insurance. And the few claim I had was, it wasn't handled well, and I don't want to get into it other than to say, ideally, the insurance company wants, whether it's life insurance, health insurance, automobile insurance, they need people that don't have claims. And they need a lot of them to offset the few people that have claims, that have the major operation, have the heart attack, have the stroke, have cancer, develop diabetes, and have to be treated. And that's the way the business works. So they're not going to take people that already have a serious medical condition that they know and the person applying knows there's a high probability that he is going to have or she is going to have large, if not huge, claims. So huge that the annual premium doesn't cover but a fraction of it. But there are always people that want something for nothing. You better believe they want something for nothing. Now, I contend, and I think I'm right on this, that the Democrats all along wanted single payer. That's what they were saying. We really want single payer. The only problem is we don't have the votes. We can't get it through the Congress. So they came up with Obamacare, hoping that, yes, it would fail. It is failing. Ladies and gentlemen, it is failing. And it has to do with adverse selection. In other words, all those people that have those pre-existing conditions, they have their insurance. And they're subsidized. And they're happy. They want Obamacare to stay. But it's a bad proposition for the insurance companies. Why? They were counting on a lot of young people. Healthy people, they were counting on healthy young people to enroll in the plans, and they weren't. They'd rather play the fine or say, let the IRS catch me if they can. And that's why more and more are withdrawing from the marketplace. Obamacare is a disaster, and it's burning up. And I have a nice, real, terrific photo that I found online. It shows a dirigible with the Obamacare name of it, Obamacare, with the logo, and President, a shadow, but they're trying to say it's President Obama looking at it, going down in flames. It's the Lindenberg fiery crash. It's crashing and burning. They also call it a death spiral. It was designed to happen because if the Democrats had the power, had the votes in the House and the Senate, and the presidency, they were going to say, well, we tried the insurance companies. It didn't work. Now it is time for single payer, universal care. They miscalculated. Why? Most people that had group insurance and really good individual coverage were happy with it, satisfied with it. I'd say 85% plus. But when you mess with someone's health insurance, and that's exactly what the Democrats did, and cause them to pay significantly higher premiums and significantly higher deductibles and buy coverage for include in there the so-called essential benefits, many of them which you don't need. People deeply resent it, and they're going to punish you. And how are they going to punish you? They're not going to vote for you in the next election. You want to know why Democrats are losing across the country? You don't have to go very far. You pay a very high price when you jam down the throat of the American people something that they weren't asking for. Remember, what was the original justification for doing this? We have the numbers seem to jump all over the place. We have somewhere between 40 and 45 million people that don't have coverage. What are we going to do? Now, note they didn't say didn't have health care. They said didn't have health insurance coverage. Now, my reaction, well, wait a minute. Let's examine that. Let's say it's 45 million. At least 10 million was going to be coverage for illegal aliens. Well, the American people weren't going to put up for that. So they were taken out, brought it down to roughly somewhere between 30 and 35 million. At least 10 million of those 35 million are people that can afford it, but they're not buying it because you couldn't force them. That's why they had to put the mandate. There were people there that had enough money, if they wanted to, could buy individual coverage, or they could buy it through their employer if they were working in a place where a group was offered, but they declined it. That happens. Usually the only time, especially young people, that young people will accept it if the employer pays for the whole thing. As long as it's not out of their pockets, fine. If you're going to give me something for free, I'll take it. But at least 10 million could afford it. At least another 10 million, maybe 15 million, were between jobs, between gigs, if you will. They were leaving one employer going to another, or they were looking for a job but would soon find one. So there's a short period of time where they don't have coverage. In other words, they're not working for their old employer, nor have they started working for their new employer. Now, it can be several months. But usually it isn't. Usually it's a couple of weeks, maybe a month, two, maybe three at the outside. And you can get temporary health insurance, but a lot of people just don't do it. They forget about it. Or they continue their previous employer's plan for a period of time. And there are some people that are just unemployed and can't afford it. Now, there's at least another 10 million, maybe more, that were poor, couldn't afford anything, below the poverty line, weren't working, might have a disability, might have a pre-existing condition. The government provides health care to them through Medicaid. To make a long story short, there's always going to be, and it depends on the economy, anywhere from 5, 10, to 15 million people that don't qualify for Medicaid. They're not working for an employer. They don't have a job, in other words, for whatever reason. Maybe they can't get one, okay? And they're discouraged. Those are the people that true. That is really the true scope of the problem. It wasn't 45 million. It was something much less. And you're going to change the whole health insurance industry to take care of, let's be generous here, we were in a recession, 15 million people. This was a bad idea that never should have got off the ground. But leave it to the Democrats to come up with bad ideas because they care. They're good intentioned. No, they're not. You're messing with the lives of at least 160 to 180 million people that like their plan. Now, I on occasion have called the Republican Party the stupid party. Well, in this Obamacare, that was real stupid. There are consequences to your actions. And when you lie about it, and they were lying through their teeth. This was their rather stealth way. We're going to get stealth. We're going to get single payer. We're going to show them. Because we won the House, the Senate, and the presidency. We're going to do it. Took them over a year, and I don't want to get into how they had to pass it. That's an old story. They made a mistake, and they're paying for mistakes. When you make a mistake, especially a serious mistake, you're going to pay for it. So there was some celebration at the White House, and President Trump brought many of the House members, the leadership, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tom Price, Kevin Brady, House Speaker, all the leadership was there. And many of the people involved were there, and there was an audience in front of them. I want to play just a few minutes. I want to play Donald Trump's comments.
I will say this, that as far as I'm concerned, your premiums, they're going to start to come down. We're going to get this passed through the Senate. I feel so confident. Your deductibles, when it comes to deductibles, they were so ridiculous that nobody got to use their current plan, this non-existent plan that I heard so many wonderful things about over the last 3 or 4 days after that. I mean, I don't think you're going to hear so much right now. The insurance companies are fleeing. It's been a catastrophe, and this is a great plan. I actually think it will get even better, and this is, make no mistake, this is a repeal and a replace of Obamacare. Make no mistake about it. Make no mistake. And I think most importantly, yes, premiums will be coming down. Yes, deductibles will be coming down. But very importantly, it's a great plan. And ultimately, that's what it's all about. We knew that wasn't going to work. I predicted it a long time ago. I said it's failing. And now it's obvious that it's failing. It's dead. It's essentially dead. If we don't pay lots of ransom money over to the insurance companies, it would die immediately. So what we have is something very, very incredibly well-crafted. Tell you what, there is a lot of talent standing behind me, an unbelievable amount of talent. That I can tell you. I mean it. And, you know, coming from a different world and only being a politician for a short period of time, how am I doing? Am I doing okay? I'm president. Hey, I'm president. Can you believe it, right? I don't know. I thought you needed a little bit more time, they always told me, more time, but we didn't. But we have an amazing group of people standing behind me. They worked so hard, and they worked so long. And what I said, let's do this. Let's go out, just short little shots for each one of us, and let's say how good this plan is. We don't have to talk about this unbelievable victory. Wasn't it unbelievable? So we don't have to say it again. But it's going to be an unbelievable victory, actually, when we get it through the Senate, and there's so much spirit there. But I said, let's go out. We have a little list of some of the people. And I think after that list goes, if they don't talk too long, our first list, we're going to let some of the other folks just come up and say whatever you want. But we want to brag about the plan because this plan really. Uh-oh. Oh. Well, yeah, we may. But we're just going to talk a little bit about the plan, how good it is, some of the great features. I want to thank Paul Ryan. He has worked so hard. And I was joking. I said, you know, Paul, for the last week, I've been hearing Paul Ryan doesn't have it. It's not working with Paul Ryan. He's going to get rid of Paul Ryan. Then today I heard Paul Ryan's a genius. He's come along. You know, the groups have all come together. We have the Tuesday group. We have so many groups. We have the Freedom Caucus. We have, and they're all great people. But we have a lot of groups, but they all came together. Really, Paul, I'd say in the last 3-4 days, especially in the last day, I see Mark and I see Kevin. I see so many people, Jim. We just have developed a bond. This has really brought the Republican Party together. As much as we've come up with a really incredible health care plan, this has brought the Republican Party together. We're going to get this finished, and then we're going, as you know, we put our tax plan in. It's a massive tax cut, the biggest tax cut in the history of our country. I used to say the biggest since Ronald Reagan. Now it's bigger than that. Also, pure tax reform. So we're going to get that done next, and this really helps it. A lot of people said, how come you kept pushing health care, knowing how tough it is? Don't forget, Obamacare took 17 months. Hillary Clinton tried so hard, really valiantly, in all fairness, to get health care through. Didn't happen. We've really been doing this for 8 weeks, if you think about it. And this is a real plan. This is a great plan. And we had no support from the other party. So I just want to introduce somebody to say a few words who really has been, I think, treated very unfairly, but it no longer matters because we won, and we're going to finish it off, and we're going to go on to a lot of other things, and we are going to have a tremendous 4 years, and maybe even more importantly, we're going to have a tremendous 8 years, but we're going to start off with just a great first year. And Paul Ryan, come up and say a few words. Congratulations on a job well done.
You get thick skin on this job. Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you. First, thank you, Mr. President. Thank you. Thank you for your leadership. There are too many people to name who played such an important role in helping us get to this part. But I want to thank a few people in particular. I want to thank Chairman Greg Walden, Kevin Brady, Diane Black, Pete Sessions, and the members of their committees for all the hard work they put into getting us to this point. I want to thank all the other members who contributed to making this the best bill possible. It really was a collaborative, consensus-driven effort. I also want to thank the team here at the White House. I want to thank Tom Price. I want to thank Mick Mulvaney. And I especially want to thank Reince Priebus. We could not have done this without you, gentlemen. You guys were the best. Of course, this would not have been possible if it weren't for these two gentlemen behind me. This is the fourth presidency I've served with. I have never, ever seen any kind of engagement like this. I want to thank Mike Pence, and I want to thank President Donald Trump for their personal involvement in working with our members and working to get this right, for getting this done and getting us to where we are. Thank you, gentlemen. Today was a big day, but it is just one step in this process, an important step. We still have a lot of work to do to get this signed into law. And I know that our friends over in the Senate are eager to get to work. They are. We're going to see that work through. You know why we're going to see this work through? Because the issues are just too important. The stakes are just too high. The problems facing American families are real. And the problems facing American families as a result of Obamacare are just too dire and too urgent. Just this week, we learned of another state, Iowa, where the last remaining health care plan is pulling out of 94 of their 99 counties, leaving most of their citizens with no plans on the Obama market at all. What kind of protection is Obamacare if there are no plans to choose from? And this is a trend that we are seeing all across the country. The truth is, this law has failed and is collapsing. Premiums are skyrocketing and choices are disappearing. and it is only getting worse, spiraling out of control. And that is why we have to repeal this law and put in place a real, vibrant marketplace with competition and lower premiums for families. That's what the American Healthcare Act is all about. It makes healthcare more affordable. It takes care of our most vulnerable, and it shifts power from Washington back to the states, and most importantly, back to you, the patient. Like I said, we've got a lot of work to do. But one thing is now clear. Republicans are committed to keeping our promise to lift the burden of Obamacare from the American people and put in place a better, more patient-centered system. It is my pleasure at this time to thank and to welcome to the stage someone who helped make this so possible, our very talented Majority Leader, Kevin McCarthy.
I remember the very first time I came down here to see the new president, President Trump. We talked about health care. You know what the president said? He said, let's not make this partisan. Don't do what you think is right for the Republican Party. Do what's right for the American country. And today, that's exactly what we did. You see, if you simply read the papers from this week, you take politics out of it, and you put people before politics, how do you look in the faces of 94 counties in Iowa out of 99? Well, not that they won't have very many choices, they'll have no choice. How do you care for pre-existing conditions when there's no care at all? Or you read the paper yesterday and you look at Aetna pulling out of Virginia, or to Tennessee next year with 16 counties with no care. Or what about those families that paid into those 23 co-ops that Obamacare created with more than $2 billion. 18 of them have collapsed, and the only answer that this American government gives them is a penalty. If you simply look at the facts, more people took the penalty or the exemption than actually signed up for Obamacare. I did not run to this office to promote a party. I ran for this office to make this country better. Yeah, and it would be easy to say no. It would be easy to watch it collapse. But I can't look at those families. I don't think that's right. And that's the exact message I got from this administration. So, Mr. President, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for your leadership. I want to thank the Vice President. You know, I've only been through a few presidents, but I've never seen someone so hands-on. Walk into my office yesterday morning, they say the president's calling again. I pick up the phone. I happen to be the majority leader, the former whip. I know my members well. The president gives me a list of who he thinks I would be best to talk to on the list. And he was right. And Mr. President, they all voted for the bill. Yeah. Today is a start. Today is the start of a new beginning. Yes, it's about providing better health care. But I happen to have been a small business owner. I listen to my district. You know how many families no longer have a 40-hour job and now have to take two part-time jobs? Or how many small businesses told me that they couldn't expand anymore because they were afraid of what Obamacare would do for them? We are going to unshackle, build an economy, let people have greater choice in their health care, and protect pre-existing conditions. And I thank you for that work.
I'm going to leave it there. For those that are new to the show and want to listen to the entire, the other people, as well as listen to the show, you go to my companion blog, pronkpops.wordpress.com. That's pronkpops, P-R-O-N-K-P-O-P-S. .wordpress.com, and under my photograph you'll have links to the most recent shows. This is show 886, but I have a lot of information and a lot of videos pertaining to the stories that I cover. I always give my listeners more information because all I ask is you have an open mind, do your own homework, and make up your own mind. I'm giving you my comments, my opinions on breaking news stories. But I make mistakes. I'm not always right. I know that. You need to do your homework, get informed, and then you'll either agree with me or partially agree with me or not. So I give you a good starting point, pointers, references, a lot of videos from YouTube, as well as articles, photographs, charts. You decide whether this is a start of the repeal of Obamacare. I think it is. I think the Republican Party very much has to repeal and replace. My fear is that it becomes Obamacare light. In other words, you still have a significant role for the federal government subsidizing people. That's what's going on. Now, the Democrats are trying to make this a disaster. The disaster is Obamacare. And the president's right. The political thing, let it crash. Crash and burn. But that's not doing the right thing. The American people never wanted Obamacare. Now, the people that got something for nothing, they were all in favor of it. Oh, you're going to give me money so I can buy health insurance? Send me the check. And many people, and this is why it was somewhat frustrating, there are people that are not working. They're unemployed, the poor. They automatically qualified for Medicaid. And yes, if you have a claim and need service, rather, that'd be the first step. Fill out the paperwork. And we expanded Medicaid. And if you know anything about most states, one of the biggest items, if not the biggest item, is Medicaid in terms of the state payments for it. Maybe education is ahead of it or highways, but Medicaid is in the top three. And it's not the best system, especially if you need a specialist, because they don't come cheap and they don't take Medicaid. And that's one of the problems. Many, many doctors, I won't say all, but many doctors, they don't handle Medicaid. And don't confuse Medicaid with Medicare. Although some doctors today, they won't accept Medicaid or Medicare. And that's what the government pays for. Now, why? They don't reimburse them enough. Remember, doctors put in long hours. They're working more than 2,000 hours a year. And if they're good, they have patients that will pay them cash or have good coverage. They don't need your business, and especially if it's Medicaid. And Medicaid is in trouble because what's happening in the United States is medical costs, health care providers, the cost of providing health care as well as doctor care, hospital care, is going up, up, and up. And the only way you're ever going to stop that is competition. As long as you have systems like you have in Europe or Canada, government pays it all, you lack accountability. You don't have the pressure that competition brings in terms of the premiums they charge, the services they provide, and the quality. See, when you're competing for customers, clients, patients in this case, the doctor or hospital that provides good, if not outstanding, care is going to get the business, not the one that you have questions about. So I'm encouraged by this first step. It isn't a perfect bill. And the $64,000 question is, what is the Senate going to propose? I think it's going to be more or less close to the House bill for the simple reason if they go either to a pro-market position, all the way to a pro-market position, or a pro-government position with a lot of government intervention, you're going to lose people on either side. So it's going to be difficult. It'll be challenging to get a bill out of the Senate. There'll be some good things in it, and I agree with President Trump. We probably will have a better bill, provided the House goes along with it. And when there's a good idea, and I think Senator Rand Paul has a good idea, not original to him, but still is pushing it and speaking for it, is allow people that don't have coverage through their employer to buy coverage through an association. That makes a lot of sense to me. And if you do that, most, if not all, of the pre-existing problem should go away because it shouldn't be individually underwritten. Because the insurance companies will be picking up a lot of people. And most people don't have pre-existing conditions. And it depends how you define them and what is the list. 4 or 5% maybe. You know, let's say it's 5%. Let's take the high number. That means 16 million people. And yeah, they're serious medical conditions. If you had several heart attacks, strokes, cancer, I'm willing to bet, and the insurance company knows it through actuarial studies, that you're going to be major claims. But as long as the number of people they're spreading the risk over is quite large, and it would be or should be in an association-type situation where they're offering you, if you want it, you don't have to buy it. It's just a benefit of membership in the association is you can buy health insurance. Now, it's going to be from a company that they've gone out and told them their situation, how many members, a minimum number of members, enrollees, or a maximum number, or some kind of situation. Insurance companies, especially large ones, they're very interested in that business. You better believe they're interested in it. Now, I want to cover, I'm looking at the time. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I am going to play another clip. Do you know what the Johnson Amendment was? I'll be honest, I didn't know what the Johnson Amendment was, and I'm in Texas. But today, President Trump signed two executive orders pertaining to promoting free speech and religious liberty, because candidate Trump pledged, one of his promises was to repeal the Johnson Amendment. Let me play, I'm debating on the order. I'm first going to have you listen to Donald Trump on the Johnson Amendment.
It was the great Thomas Jefferson who said, "The God who gave us life gave us liberty." Jefferson asked, "Can the liberties of a nation be secure when we have removed a conviction that these liberties are the gift of God?" Among those freedoms is the right to worship according to our own beliefs. That is why I will get rid of and totally destroy the Johnson Amendment and allow our representatives of faith to speak freely and without fear of retribution. I will do that. Remember.
Now, that is definitely popular with people of faith, whatever their religion. But I'm sure many of you, even if you remember that, don't know what the Johnson Amendment is. Well, let's listen to someone explain it to you. The history of the Johnson Amendment.
For almost the first 200 years of American history, pastors spoke freely and boldly from their pulpits about the issues of the day. Pastors preached election sermons, giving instruction to newly elected officials on what Scripture said about the issues confronting government. Pastors also frequently supported or opposed candidates from their pulpits, going as far back as the presidential election of 1800 and continuing through successive elections. But all that changed in 1954 with the passage of the Johnson Amendment, which effectively overturned almost 200 years of church history in America. To understand the history of the Johnson Amendment, you need to know the circumstances behind the 1954 U.S. senatorial race. In 1954, Lyndon B. Johnson, a powerful Texas politician, was running for re-election to the U.S. Senate. Johnson's opponent was Dudley Dougherty, a 30-year-old first-term state senator from Beeville, Texas. Dougherty was not going to present much of a problem for Johnson, and Johnson felt that he would easily win re-election. That is until two very powerful men impacted the race through the nonprofit organizations they had created. One man was H.L. Hunt, a Texas oil man, and the other was Frank Gannett, the publishing mogul. Hunt created a nonprofit organization called Facts Forum in 1951. Gannett created a nonprofit organization called the Committee for Constitutional Government in 1935. Both of these organizations were anti-communist, and both were supporting Dougherty in his race against Johnson. Hunt and Gannett believed that Johnson was soft on communism and did not want to see him reelected to the Senate. These two nonprofit organizations passed out thousands of pieces of literature in opposition to Johnson's campaign. Now, when Johnson saw that his chances for reelection were in danger, he tried to find ways of silencing them. He inquired with the Texas Election Commission and even with the IRS whether these groups were violating any law. Johnson was told that these groups were not breaking any laws. In the midst of the campaign, he finally hit on an idea to muzzle these organizations who were opposing his chances for re-election. He showed up on the floor of the Senate on July 2, 1954, and offered an amendment to a pending tax overhaul bill. This was a massive bill to modernize the tax code. The legislative history on that day shows that Johnson offered his amendment and declared that the sponsor of the tax bill had agreed to it. The amendment passed by a unanimous voice vote. The bill was passed, and President Eisenhower signed it into law on August 16, 1954. There were no committee hearings on the bill, no legislative analysis, and no attempt to understand the effect this bill might have on the constitutional right of churches and pastors. Johnson's chief aide at the time, a man named George Reedy, was interviewed many years after the fact and stated that Johnson never had churches in mind when he proposed this amendment. One scholar who studied this extensively concluded that the Johnson Amendment is not rooted in constitutional provisions for separation of church and state. Johnson was not trying to address any constitutional issue related to separation of church and state, and he did not offer the amendment because of anything that churches had done. Churches were not banned from endorsing candidates because they are religious organizations. They were banned because they have the same tax-exempt status as Facts Forum and the Committee for Constitutional Government, the right-wing organizations that Johnson was really after. Never let anyone tell you that the Johnson Amendment is intended to protect the so-called separation of church and state. Nothing could be further from the truth. This law was a revenge-motivated law passed by a powerful senator who knew how to use the political process to silence his opponents. You can find out more information about the Johnson Amendment and what Alliance Defending Freedom is doing to combat this unconstitutional restriction at pulpitfreedom.org.
Now, I thought this was a very useful audio clip because, like I said, I wasn't aware of the Johnson Amendment. Now, I am aware of 501c3 groups and their restrictions on them. But why many people are impressed with that executive order, and I'm one of them, it doesn't go far enough. Because if a Democrat should be elected president, there's a high probability they will issue an executive order reinstating the Johnson Amendment. If you truly want to permanently change something, or I won't say permanently, but change something and not make it easy to undo it, it needs to be part of a bill. Repealing the Johnson Amendment because it's part of the Internal Revenue Code and regulations. That's why many people that very much want the repeal of the Johnson Amendment are saying it doesn't go far enough. Now, one other thing I need to say. How significant is the Johnson Amendment? Rarely does the IRS enforce it against churches, but they could at any time do it. And that's what you got to keep in mind. The bigger concern is other 501c3s. I want to do away with that. I don't want to give the discretion to the IRS. I believe in both freedom of speech and religious liberty. So I applaud the president signing the executive orders, but let's take it a step further and repeal the regulation and the code sections that have that amendment in it. Most people, Texans included, have totally forgotten about the amendment. Many pastors don't even know what the Johnson Amendment is. But there are people, pastors, priests, that do know it and will support efforts to repeal the Johnson Amendment. And I will support them in that task. Now, I have one more clip. Getting back to Trump as a candidate, that's a little bit more detailed.
Each of us here today has a role to play in bringing our country together, united in common purpose and in common values. So let's talk today about some of the things, and these are great things, that we can do together to create the American future for everybody, not just a certain group of people, but for everybody. The first thing we have to do is give our churches their voice back. It's been taken away. The Johnson Amendment has blocked our pastors and ministers and others from speaking their minds from their own pulpits. If they want to talk about Christianity, if they want to preach, if they want to talk about politics, they're unable to do so. If they want to do it, they take a tremendous risk that they lose their tax-exempt status. All religious leaders should be able to freely express their thoughts and feelings on religious matters. And I will repeal the Johnson Amendment if I am elected your president. I promise. So important. Thank you. That's so important. And I must tell you from the heart, this started a building of mine in Manhattan. I had 50 pastors in a big conference room. And we actually had 50 pastors, two rabbis, a couple of priests, We were all talking, and we were there for 2 hours, and at the end, it was a love fest. We all agreed, it was like a love fest. And I said to them, we were high up in a building on Fifth Avenue, and I said to them, I'd love your support. And I know when I can get support. I'm quite sophisticated. And I know they wanted to give me their total support, 100%, just like I had in the primaries. And I said, I really would like your support. And they didn't really know what I was talking about. And I said, what's going on here? They said, well, sir, we can't do that because we would be violating the laws. And I said, what's the punishment? Well, we could lose our tax-exempt status, which, of course, is a, you know, massive penalty. I said, tell me about this. And we sat down, they talked about it. When did it happen? 1954 or so. Lyndon Johnson was having problems. Powerful guy. I actually, in his own way, you have to gain respect for what he was able to do. Can you imagine that this man single-handedly, he was having problems with churches. And there was a church in Houston that was giving him a hard time, maybe for very good reason. And he put in an amendment that basically stopped our great pastors and ministers and others from talking under the penalty of losing their tax-exempt status. So we were looking down onto the sidewalk, and there were people walking on the sidewalk. And I said, so, folks, what you're telling me is those people walking way, way down there on the sidewalk have really more power than you do because they're allowed to express their feelings and thoughts openly and without penalty. And one of the pastors who I knew very well, and these are powerful people, these are strong people with magnificent voices and just, and magnificent hearts, much more importantly. They looked at me and they said, that's actually right. They have more power than we do. We're not allowed to express. And that's when I said, we have to start thinking about this. And I thought about it. And then we had a large group of pastors again. I said, I have thought about it. If I become president, we are going to knock out the Johnson Amendment. We are going to do that. And it's not going to be hard. It's not going to be hard. When you think from the standpoint of political, you have more than men. Let's say men are 50%, women are 50%. You're much more than 50% added together. And I actually believe that's one of the reasons why you haven't seen Christianity and other religions within the United States going like a rocket ship, like our polls have been going in the last 4 weeks, a rocket ship, right? I really believe that. Because you're great people. The people that you rely on Sunday and all during the week, they've been stopped from talking and speaking by a law. And we're going to get rid of that law. We're going to get rid of it so fast. And I'm so proud to say, honestly, I don't want to take credit, but you had 50 people in that first meeting and many more in the second. I'm so proud. I was just telling this to Tony, to say, that was my idea. I figure it's the only way I'm getting to heaven, so this is going to be very good. The only way. So we're going to get rid of it, and we're going to let your great people speak, and you're going to see something happen that's going to be very, very good. Okay? So important. I hope, which means you have to get out and vote. On November 8th, you cannot, you didn't vote 4 years ago. You didn't vote. You didn't. Well, you did. A few of you did. Believe me, I know. I look at the stats. You didn't vote. But this time you really have. And this is your last chance. This is it. I mean, we'll never have this opportunity again. So I hope you can get every one of your friends and just get up, your family and your friends, and get out and vote. Okay? November 8th.
That was candidate Trump speaking to a group. I'm glad he did this because most Americans aren't aware of it. I consider myself fairly well informed. I wasn't aware of it. I should have been aware of it, but I wasn't. And I was listening to a group, and one of the people on the panel said, many pastors are not aware of it either. Now, the one thing I will say, it's rarely enforced, but it's always hanging over them. I want to thank you for listening to the show. And now, America the Beautiful.
My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College. You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom, first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by PronkPops.wordpress.com and KDUX Web Radio.wordpress.com.